I've looked at clouds from both sides now, on Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. We'll do some Martian cloud watching with atmospheric scientist and solar system explorer Mark Lemon. And when we're done staring at the clouds, we'll ask Mark about dust, fog, and snow, yeah, snow, on the red planet. Snow falls lightly. Asteroids, not so much. Of course, Bruce Betts will also join me for this week's What's Up and his latest space trivia contest. File this under Why Didn't We Think of That? There's an image of China's first Mars rover next to its landing platform at the top of the June 18 Downlink newsletter. It's not a selfie. The rover dropped off a wireless camera and then backed up into the resulting image. Pretty cool, and you can see it at planetary.org/downlink. Of course, there's also this helicopter on Mars. The headlines include very good news for everyone who wants to avoid a deep impact. NASA is moving forward with the infrared space telescope called NEO Surveyor. We'll soon welcome back the Asteroid Hunter's principal investigator, Amy Meinzer. You've probably heard that China has astronauts back in space for the first time in several years. The three men are aboard the nation's first space station. Meanwhile, the first Space Launch System rocket is coming together in the Kennedy Space Center's Vehicle Assembly Building. The giant core stage has been mated to the twin solid rocket boosters. Lastly, comes word that a Finnish company is building the first nanosatellite made from wood. Plywood, actually. How long could it be till someone builds one out of Legos? Mark Lemon has joined us a couple of times. He's now a senior research scientist at the Space Science Institute in College Station, Texas. But his work has put him in a virtual sense in the skies of Jupiter, Titan, and especially Mars. He studies aerosols, stuff suspended in the air of these worlds. Along the way, he has become one of Earth's most experienced and accomplished photographers on other worlds, including his work as imaging team lead for the Phoenix Mars lander. He's also a co-investigator using MassCam-Z on the Perseverance rover. Mark was quoted in a Jet Propulsion Lab media release that led me back to his door for a conversation that began with those clouds above Mars. Mark Lemon, welcome back to Planetary Radio. Good to be talking about the clouds of Mars, although we have some other things that we may want to cover as well. Welcome.
Well, hello. It's great to be here again.
So when we talked 10 years ago, we were still mourning the loss of Mars exploration rover Spirit. We were looking forward to picking a landing spot for the Mars Science Laboratory, Curiosity. I believe you're still working with Curiosity as it crawls up Mount Sharp. We'll talk about that too. And you're on the MassCam-Z team for Perseverance. Phoenix has come and gone. InSight still going strong. MAVEN, the UAE's Hope, India's Mom, and others looking down from above. That's a lot of exploration and science. What has most excited or surprised you after 10 more years of observing Mars?
Well, it's a great time to be trying to explore Mars because we've got all of these wonderful assets that are participating in the exploration. I love being on the rover teams, the lander teams as well, when there's that chance. It is just startling on maybe not a day-to-day basis, but certainly a month-to-month and a year-to-year basis that we can have this rover sitting there on Mars and find new things. We've intentionally set out to find new things, and we're still doing it on purpose. And then we're also doing it because Mars decides to show us something. So it's just excellent.
That is such a regular theme across almost every show we do, every person that I get to talk to, that there is no end to the surprises out there across our solar system and beyond. Do you still actually work with commands, write commands that get sent to Curiosity to tell it what it should look at and image?
Well, I've had a lot of different roles on the different missions as time goes by, and some of them have literally been writing you know, the last human readable version of the command file before it gets translated into something that the rover can execute. What I do on Curiosity, on Perseverance, is work with a very slightly higher level version of the commands and occasionally dabble in the actual command itself. But there are people who are responsible for that who have lots of training in the system engineering of the protocols for ensuring safety and things like that. There are a lot of people to make sure that I don't go and point the camera in a way that it's going to cause damage, that sort of thing. They make sure that they follow all of the rules. I worry about composing the pictures, making sure that they're going to achieve the science that I want, and that level of manipulating the commands. But yeah, I am, you know, sitting there saying, well, I want this rover to take a picture using these filters to see these wavelengths of light at that particular time. You know, then I get the privilege of seeing this imaging sequence that I dreamed up happen and play with the data when we get them back from Mars. It's great.
That is a heck of a thing to be able to do and tell people, yeah, I take pictures on Mars for a living, in part. and I want to talk to you maybe toward the end of this conversation about what it takes to get a good picture, a good snapshot on Mars. Let's get to the story that caught my eye and made me think, shoot, I've got to bring Mark Lemon back. And this was a press release just recently about what we're learning about the clouds of Mars, which, you know, we've been seeing those for ages. But it was the beauty of some of these new images that really caught my eye, quite literally. I knew I had to talk to you about it. Tell us about these, first of all. I mean, what are these new clouds and what are they made of?
Yeah, clouds on Mars and our observations of them go way back. We were observing them from Earth before we ever sent anything to Mars. So it's not a surprise that there are clouds. We get to Mars with some of the things to be able to characterize them, starting, you know, with the orbiters, the first landers, and now the rovers. We're able to see the clouds in different ways. We've known, again, for some time that there are a couple kinds of clouds. There are water ice clouds. And depending on where you are on Mars, those water ice clouds can form as low as the surface. They're fog in some places. And they're high altitude clouds, 15 kilometers, 10 miles in other places. Then Mars also has carbon dioxide clouds, dry ice. And these are frequently caused by gravity waves when basically a hot, cold section of atmosphere propagates itself upward with pressure changes. And when the atmosphere cools, it's already very cold. You get the atmosphere itself below the freezing point of that atmosphere, which is carbon dioxide, and the carbon dioxide freezes out and you get clouds. Yeah, we took pictures of those clouds with Pathfinder. We've seen them from orbit. We've seen them from time to time, but there's not a ton of information about all of the different kinds. You know, we've seen in daytime images with Curiosity, we see clouds all the time. They're not all the time. We've seen them every year. There are seasons for them. And we see these faint, wavy patterns, these wave clouds, and have tried to characterize those. But we were shocked 2 years ago to see clouds during a time of year that we thought of as not cloudy for that particular site, which was right after the turn of the year, the northern spring equinox. And we got a few pictures of them at the time, but that turned out to be a very limited cloud season. But we could use some old data that we had to show that this was not a one-time occurrence. This had actually been happening and we just didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. So we put a note on the calendar and this year came back to it and it coincided essentially with Perseverance landing. Huh. So that was a very, very busy time dealing with Perseverance on the one hand and then trying to characterize these clouds that we saw with Curiosity on the other. But we put together this great set of observations. You know, you've seen some of the results in these pictures that came out.
They are gorgeous. We will put up a link to the press release that has some of these photos, and there are links from that as well. But we'll put that on this week's show page at planetary.org/radio. I was shocked to read that some of these carbon dioxide clouds are more than 60 kilometers up, or about 200,000 feet, more than 200,000 feet. I'm surprised to learn that there's enough atmosphere at that height, especially above Mars, that you could have clouds. Was this a surprise to any of you?
It's a surprise in a bigger picture sense. We knew it before we took these pictures, but it's certainly stunning to think about an atmosphere that's already 1% of what we have on Earth at the surface. And then you go 70 kilometers above that, and we're seeing clouds. But those clouds have been seen from orbit. There was actually even about the same time we saw these clouds the first time with Curiosity, a paper came out from Todd Clancy using spectra taken from orbit to show that some particular high altitude, 60 kilometer altitude clouds that he was looking at were carbon dioxide. He could actually see the composition because he had spectra. And then with the spectra, he could tell that they were iridescent clouds. Iridescence shows up in spectroscopy differently than it does in the images, and you get this nice wavy spectrum. And he looks at that and says, what in the world is it doing that? Oh, that's an iridescent cloud, which means that it's a cloud full of cloud particles that are all just about the same size. So they all scatter light in exactly the same way. It all adds up in a coherent way. And you get what visually looks like this variation of pastel colors. They're spectacular clouds to look at on Earth. They're spectacular clouds to see on Mars. But that first indication was from the spectra from orbit that we actually had iridescence. As it happened, I had seen the iridescence in the pictures before I found out about that. But the paper was being published at the time. So it's a way to see the same thing in two very different ways. So we know that there are these high altitude clouds. The orbiters see them, and we've even Mars Pathfinder, in some of the few images that it got in the twilight, saw clouds that were, because the sun was shining on them when the sun was way down, they were demonstrated to be 50 plus kilometers high. That's essentially what we can see with these clouds is with the images from Curiosity, we can't measure that they're carbon dioxide. We can't measure that they're water ice. But because of the timing that we took the images, and especially some of the NavCam images, the black and white ones that we released, where you can see the sunset line move across the clouds. Mm. It's basically the shadow of Mars projecting onto the clouds. And that tells you what the altitude is. So we can use that and figure out that whatever these clouds are, we're looking at clouds that are up 50, 60, 70 kilometers, depending on the night and the season. From that, we start inferring that, well, the orbiters that can measure the composition do see water ice up to around 50 kilometers sometimes. But by the time you're above that, it's almost always CO2.
I love that you could, in part, tell how high these clouds were by watching the sun crawl across them as it set. Pythagoras would be so proud. there was a word applied to these twilight or even nighttime clouds. I imagine a lot of us have seen them here on Earth, but I had not seen the word before, noctilucent.
Yeah, there are a couple of words that I have used for these clouds that are, you know, not quite everyday conversation. These are noctilucent clouds, night shining, noctilucent, and that describes clouds that are so high that the sun is still shining on them after it has gone from the surface, and they're bright. They might be in the sky in the daytime, but you might miss them because they're faint, they're thin. But at night, then they are the only things that the sun is shining on. You cannot miss them. And so they're very commonly seen from high latitudes. They're clouds above the troposphere. The ones in the troposphere, the sun sets on, you know, close enough to the same time that they never get outstandingly bright. They make for beautiful sunsets, but they're not noctilucent clouds. These ones that are up in the mesosphere, basically up at similar altitudes on Earth to where we see them on Mars, those clouds are the noctilucent clouds. And then among the noctilucent clouds, you can also see clouds that are iridescent. And iridescence is when you see the wavy colors across the clouds. Yeah. And you can see that in the daytime too. If you find clouds that have, all the particles have the same formation history, so usually young clouds, then you have a whole bunch of particles of the same or almost the same size. They scatter light the same way. And this cloud that would otherwise be white suddenly has red and green and blue parts to it. And it's still just water, typically, when you see in the daytime on Earth. Well, when you see that iridescent cloud that is also noctilucent, the name that we have for that on Earth are nacreous clouds.
Nacreous?
Nacreous clouds.
Okay.
And the less highfalutin name that we have for those on Earth is Mother of Pearl Clouds.
Oh, yes. Now that I saw. And I have seen these. I hope all of you out there have seen them. And really, I'm not kidding, folks. You need to take a look at some of these images, at least one of them, of these iridescent or Mother of Pearl Clouds in the high atmosphere of Mars. It is just sublimely beautiful. Really, science at its artistic best.
Yeah, I'd never seen colors like that on Mars, except in, you know, colorful things that we took with us. And to actually see Mars making colors like that was awesome.
I got a question for you that I wasn't expecting to ask because it didn't occur to me. I was many, many years ago in the Southwest, hot, dry day, and looked up at the sky with a whole bunch of other people who were there, and we saw color in the sky. We couldn't see clouds, at least I don't remember seeing clouds, but there were the same sorts of faint color that we could see. Does that make any sense to you? Is that a phenomenon that you are familiar with?
I've certainly seen ice clouds, sometimes colorful ones, in a similar environment, anywhere from Tucson to here, a more humid version of that, Texas. The clouds that do that would likely be very thin clouds with very uniform particle sizes. So you basically don't necessarily see the white of the cloud.
Mm.
And then you see the shimmering colors from it. And that's just telling you that you have ice particles that are all about the same size. And this is probably, I'm just guessing here, I didn't see what you saw, probably very close to the tropopause. So again, you know, above 10 kilometers.
Thank you for helping to possibly solve a decades-old mystery, at least a mystery to me. If I was standing on Mars under some of these iridescent clouds, looking up at them through my helmet faceplate, would I, with my naked eye, be able to see some of these colors, or is that something I need instrumentation for?
I find it very difficult to predict the details of what you would see when you look at look at anything through a picture and then look at it with your own eyes. It's always surprising to go from one to the other. But in my experience, yeah, those are colors that you would see. It wouldn't look precisely like the picture because we would perceive things differently. But again, we would be in a dark environment with a slightly bright sky and then have these shimmering colors above us. You know, those were not super processed to bring out things that we would not otherwise see. Those were calibrated images. Yeah, they're displayed a certain way, but you have that problem whenever you show an image on a monitor.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of issue, but there was no particular effort put into making those clouds look more spectacular than they are. They just are like that. And when you get away from looking towards sunset, the pictures with the colors are looking above the area where the sun set previously. When you look away from there, you don't get the iridescence nearly as much. It fades off pretty quickly.
Hmm.
And then you tend to see essentially the whitish clouds in the tannish and darkening sky. So when the pictures taken in other directions don't have those shimmering colors.
I got to hope anyway, that in some number of decades, there are going to be Martians on Mars, human Martians who... we'll be out on expeditions and maybe just love the thought that, hey, I got to see some Mother of Pearl clouds the other day. I read that you were doing a lot of this work from home even before the pandemic forced a whole lot of us to join you working from home. How does it feel to sit at your breakfast table or whatever and work with spacecraft on another world?
Oh, it's great. And, the commute is excellent because the Martian day is different from ours and the rovers are in different places. And who knows what time of day we're going to get data that I'm interested in. I can wake up in the morning, start some coffee and sit down and catch up on things right away. I have to do some things to try and keep my home life separate from my work life, that it is tempting to find a lot of time working. I think a lot of people fall into that naturally when home becomes work and vice versa.
Tell me about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mark, I like to say to astronomers, clear skies. I guess that's not exactly what you want to hear in your line of business and in your arm of planetary science. But just the same, I hope that you'll be able to keep up this great work and sharing it with us for many more years to come and maybe from many other worlds. Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you and getting this update.
Well, thank you.
You'll hear much more of Mark Lemon at planetary.org/radio, along with Kate Howells on what those asteroid blockbusters Armageddon and Deep Impact got right and got very, very wrong. I'll be right back with Bruce Betts here on Planetary Radio.
Hi, I'm Kate from the Planetary Society. For all its troubles, 2020 has still seen some terrific space accomplishments. We asked our members and supporters to vote for their 2020 favorites. You can see the results at planetary.org/best of 2020. We're talking about the best solar system image, the most exciting moment in planetary science, and much more. That's planetary.org/best of 2020. Happy holidays from the Planetary Society.
Bill Nye, the planetary guy here. The threat of a deadly asteroid impact is real. The answer to avoiding it? Science. And you. It's the only large-scale natural disaster that could one day be prevented. The Society is getting ready to award its next round of Shoemaker Near-Earth Object Grants to talented astronomers around the world. You can learn more about this opportunity and our other work at planetary.org/neo. We're just trying to save the world.
It is time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Here is the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts, is with us once again. Hi there. Welcome. Good evening.
Hello. Hey there. Hi there. And ho there.
I figured good evening would be a good lead-in for giving us that tour of the night sky that you always provide.
It is a good evening, at least if it's not cloudy for you. There'll be a lot of good evenings coming up. If you look low in the west shortly after sunset, you'll be able to see super bright Venus shining there. It's gotten fairly easy to see if you have any kind of decent view to the western horizon. And above Venus is much dimmer reddish Mars, and they will be getting closer and closer together until July 12th, when we'll be snuggling with each other. And in the middle of the night, Jupiter, looking really bright, and Saturn, looking yellowish, rising in the middle of the night in the east and off high in the south by pre-dawn. And to complete our naked eye planet visibility, we've even got Mercury making an apparition low in the pre-dawn east. So all five planets you can see without a telescope. And I'll add a couple cute lineups as well. We've got Venus, Pollux, and Castor. The Gemini twin stars are kind of in a nice line on June 24th, and then kind of a line after that. And the Moon hanging out with Jupiter and Saturn on June 28th. We move on to This Week in Space History. Hey, it was 2 years ago this week that LightSail 2 launched aboard of Falcon Heavy, and we're still up there solar sailing 2 years later, so that's exciting.
And looking good? I mean, things are still healthy. Is there any degradation?
There is. It's getting a little, a little fuzzier in the brain. The sail has got more crinkles, and it has a few spots that look like the aluminized part is delaminating. I've got an article coming out on the 25th on our website at planetary.org, a longer update about what we're doing in the extended mission.
A little fuzzier in the brain, aren't we all?
Huh?
Exactly.
I'm going to darken the mood in remembering the passing of the Soyuz 11 crew, which occurred this week in 1971 when their cabin depressurized due to a faulty valve. Georgi Dobryovsky, Vladislav Volkov, Viktor Patsyayev all perished and are the only three people to have perished above the von Karman line to have died in space. We move on to Random Space Fact. So, that Soyuz 11 crew, I found out something I didn't realize. One, let's credit is due. They were the first to live on board a space station, Salyut 1, for 22 days. But they were actually the backup crew until just a couple days before launch.
Wow.
Had you ever heard this?
No.
Yeah, an X-ray of one of the primary crew's lungs showed what they thought was tuberculosis indications, a dark spot on the X-ray. So they actually chose to completely go with the backup crew, and the primary crew, Leonov, Kubasov, and Kolodin, were sidelined turned out that Kubasov, who they thought had tuberculosis, just had a cold.
Oh my gosh. There but for the grace of the Russian Space Agency, I guess, or the Soviet Space Agency at that time. That's quite a story.
One of those trippy stories. Two of the three primary crew went on to fly on Apollo Soyuz. All right, we move on to happier times in the trivia contest. Who holds the record for the most launches to space from Earth at 7? How'd we do, Matt?
Let me give you the rhyming answer to this. Then we can talk a little bit more about it, because this tripped up quite a few people, actually. Gene Lewin in Washington submitted, Jerry Ross reached his 7th space launch, all from this marble blue, but Franklin Chang Diaz kept up that pace in 7. He completed 2. Jerry Ross flew in 3 different craft. Chang Diaz added Discovery. So though they are tied both with 7 in trips, in ships, Diaz leads 4-3.
Nice. Not only poetry, but an additional random space fact. I like it.
Thank you very much, Gene. Here is our winner, first-time winner, Judy Engelsberg in New Jersey, the Garden State. Really is, if you get out of Newark and places like that. Anyway, Judy got it right with Jerry Ross and Franklin Chang Diaz. She adds to that, greetings, Earthlings and astrophage, little tip of the space helmet there to our friend Andy Weir and his new book. Congrats, Judy. You have won yourself both a Planetary Radio t-shirt and a copy of Brian Keating's book that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, losing the Nobel Prize.
We go to Constellations Land. What is the only one of the 88 official IAU constellations named for an actual historic person? Named for an actual person. What's the only constellation of the official constellations? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
So that leaves out Betts and Dog, because you're not yet one of the officially identified.
Yeah, it's just unofficial, but important.
You have this time until the 30th. That would be June 30th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer. And I have another copy of that great book, the one I was raving about last week, Carbon, One Atom's Odyssey by John Barnett. It is published by No Starch Press, and this will also go to the winner. It is gorgeous. I think whoever gets this, whether you win it from us or get it on your own, will probably display it very proudly and enjoy his wonderful drawings. We're done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about windy planets. Thank you. Good night.
Windy planets. Yeah, of course there are some, but Bruce mentions this because just before we started, my grandson informed me that he's now going to call Uranus and Neptune the windy planets because they just look that way. And I said, yeah, not bad. Do you agree, planetary scientist?
I do. I do. Neptune and even has the fastest measured winds in the solar system. So yeah, windy planets.
There you go. The chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts, is in full agreement with the equally distinguished 5-year-old Rowan as we close out this edition of What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members who see all sorts of wonders in the sky. Mark Hilverda and Jason Davis are our associate producers. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which is arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser at Astro.